Africa's Hugh Maxakela with Timlela. It's from his 2002 album, Time. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and of course, the results of yesterday's primaries in West Virginia and Nebraska, with Donald Trump capturing both states and Bernie Sanders besting Hillary Clinton in West Virginia, have only moved political outcomes even closer to that word that we've been using since Monday, inevitability. Yes, Trump has no major impediments to clinching the Republican nomination, and Sanders' win did little to blunt Clinton's lead in delegates. And she seems to be the inevitable nominee. The duopoly, folks, continues to take care of party business in the lead-up to the general election in November, when inevitably there will be a new president in the White House. But we return to our three-day-old discussion now about what new approaches and how best do we prepare to cope with what soon will be our collective reality. Lots and lots and lots of analysis, and I don't even watch it anymore. I'm satisfied. In fact, I feel pretty good that we got the picture rather clear. We got it very, very clearly a long time ago. And we saw this coming. This is not a surprise necessarily. But we also did get very clearly what the process was about. It was about the duopoly, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party taking care of their respective business. It's 4 years since the last president has been in office. Time for a change. And, they go through this thing called the elections. But we did get to see the innards of the beast a bit more so than, I suppose, in previous elections, where we get to appreciate the role, the sub rosa world of delegates and super delegates, and how the parties have all these various ways of nullifying the popular vote and actually railroading democracy while touting the very tenets of democracy. this is democracy. And yes, we have ways of railroading it, but that too is part of the democratic process. We can't join that. We know that. It is not for us. That game is not for us. So we are clear about that. What we should be talking about is what is next? What are we doing? How do we really use this moment of clarity to reconfigure our thinking about politics, about our role in politics, about what we can do to leverage and to aggregate our power, and then to leverage that aggregate power for a common cause? And to this degree, I think we will have come through this process with some kind of a benefit, in that we're putting our learning into action. I have absolutely no confidence at all in the political system. I have shared with listeners that my revelation came almost 20 years ago in a voting booth. That the voting process was an insult to me as a concerned, civic-minded person. And in the voting booth, it occurred to me that this was just such a horrible, cruel hoax and a joke. Because there was just no way that the system really wanted or needed my participation in anything, except to create the illusion of some formal process that had occurred that supposedly meant that I, the citizen, gave permission or somehow let my will be known, and that is summarized by a vote, and on the basis of that vote, things happen. New policies are enacted and so forth. That hit me like a rock right there in the voting booth, I swear to you. I was such a conscientious voter. I was so intent on utilizing this power that I had to let the system know my will. And, of course, to pay attention after the vote was over to the aggregate will. What was the feeling among other people like myself? And then how would that translate into a shift away from what was undesirable into to something else that was going to be of greater benefit, a better way to go? None of that ever happened. This was all a joke. And I vowed right there in the voting booth, I will not ever vote again unless there is a compelling reason for me to vote. A compelling reason. Sadly, I must report to you, I have found no compelling reason to vote since then until now. Not even with the two elections of Barack Obama. I didn't participate in the first vote, and I certainly did not participate in the re-election vote. Because by then, I had really taken a forensic look at this system and its relationship to me and to the people generally, and I concluded that the system is rigged. There is no real intent here to have participatory democracy. That was just my feeling. And I made my decision on that basis. I said, unless there is a compelling reason, I'm out. And instead, I chose to kind of transform my whole idea about politics, what politics should be for me, what it should mean to me, and how I exercise my political power, the power that I have. And I do believe I have political power, and I believe everybody has political power. I think, though, that we have to kind of mature into the our understanding of it. And we have to use it strategically and almost militarily. We have to use it very, very carefully. And the things that I choose to do, which I have redefined as my political expression, I find greater satisfaction with that than with this nonsensical quadrennial exercise of running around waiting to see what the next news will be, and it of course we learning what the next news would be, the charade passing for serious political endeavor. It is not. It is very scary how unhinged from political reality we are. And this sordid thing that is unfolding before our eyes, that we are being convinced by a compliant media, they're saying to us, it's part of the political process. No, it's not. it is an offense of the greatest order to anything remotely connected to what you would think is the political process. It isn't. That's my own view. So I believe that it was important for me to do something different. And I've tried that, and I find greater satisfaction in doing that. I don't regret at all absenting myself from this carnival, and instead using whatever I define as my political leverage in a different way. And I think this is something that is worthy of consideration on a mass basis, on a mass scale. This is not to say that mass movements are no longer important. Absolutely, quite the opposite. Mass movements are absolutely important, but it must be informed in the end by an individual insight and a reconfiguration of what we mean by politics, and therefore what we mean by political activism. And because none of what is going on in the name of politics today has anything to do with the aggregate good, it seems to me that communities such as ours need to concern ourselves with this question. We need to grapple with this question. What then is politics to us? How do we do politics? How do we define politics? What do we do with this thing called political power? How do we put it to use? How do we express it? And how do we build anything akin to a mass movement around this reconfigured definition of politics? It seems to me to be at the root of a large question that involves our collective salvation. We seem headed for monumental disasters that will require us to respond if the system allows it. We have yielded so much of our power to this thing called the system, and it has taken so much on its own to the point where we seem intimidated to do the building that is necessary, the galvanizing of effort, the creation of community, so that we can galvanize our efforts for the shared benefit, for the aggregate good, that we seem to be stymied just at the thought of taking on this assignment. And this is a good time to do some introspection. This is a good time for us to raise the questions. This is a good time for self-criticism, self-examination. What are the contradictions we have ourselves that are impeding our progress? And isn't this the perfect opportunity to begin the process of reconstruction? I think this is the perfect time because we're smack in the middle of a huge crisis, and it's going to get even worse. The daunting reality, and this is the inevitability that I must use the word for, the inevitability of it is that we will be confronted with a series of catastrophes so enormous that just the sheer idea that we should respond is enough to keep us quiet. We would be so intimidated by the enormity of the task, by our unpreparedness to take on this system, that we will be completely paralyzed, immobilized. A lot has happened in our community that went on kind of without critique. We are fractured. We have incorporated the same things, the same flaws that exist in a society, we continue to say, is just not nearly as enlightened. But as enlightened as our community is, it is racist, it is sexist, it is narrow-minded, it lacks vision and initiative, it is imperialistic in many ways, saying that only certain people within our community actually have the wherewithal and the talent and the vision to lead. It has incorporated exactly the same contradictions as the other world that we fight all the time. And we are loath, we are reluctant to call ourselves out. So these things have grown into festering sores and have become major impediments themselves to us organizing. I make the notation all the time about feminism being racist and sexist. Oh, yes. You can't ask me to be a feminist as defined by the feminists today. I want no part of that. I want no part of misogyny. And that definition of feminism is not healthy for my culture and my people. That's not a good argument to make, that we should be setting up the dynamic of women versus men. My community has a horrible, horrible problem here, in that we have borne the brunt of that kind of miscegenation. So I have no use for that. And then people would say, well, we have no use for you. So you see, we can't begin a conversation where my views are as legitimate as anybody else's, because they are deeply rooted in a relevant historical context. The relevant historical context being the targeted attack on my community to separate men from women, separate families, to create division, to create warfare, internecine warfare, to keep us all fractured at all times. We need the exact opposite. We need a model that helps us build. We need a model that helps us get together. We need a model that helps us heal, that is culturally relevant and culturally based. It doesn't terrify anybody else, and it shouldn't, but it doesn't mean that it should be subsumed to anybody else's idea of what family should be, or what feminism should be. You see, these are the things that we have to deal with, the contradictions. So we come back to the discussion that has been going on since Monday, and I ask you, what are your thoughts at 888-874-4888? In this moment where we are, is it time to revise our own approaches to politics? Is it time to put something else on the table to articulate different views that might work, that might have relevance, and that we might put into play, because we will need something to fight with. We will need it. It's coming. It's already here. So we'll take this break, come back to your thoughts, and we will build on the conversation at 888-874-4888 right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're talking about building a whole new apparatus, because we'll need it. It's the time is now. Ken from New York, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Eutrice. First off, I just want to thank you for the love that you have given, that you put out there.
Thank you so much.
You're a voice of reality and realism and truth. And, I mean, this is a long, big thank you from the years I've been listening to you, even when you were at BAI. And I love you, and I pray for your healing. And
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
With you. I really appreciate you. No, you, sister. You know, because I left New York in 89, came back in 99, and, you know, I'd missed the city sun, which you were, that's one of the reasons I came back to New York. I was like, no one knows anything in the world. I'm on the West Coast, and no one's got a grip on what's really going on in the world. Let me go back to the East Coast. So anyway, my point is, you know, living in upstate New York, you know, I agree with you. Haki Mahubuti, the creator of Third World Press, wrote a book in 1980 called Enemies, Clash of the Races. Very hard-edged book. And his perspective was that any system or any organization or any form of government or business that comes from the mind of people who occupy the, north of Africa, okay, that whole European, you know, section, is incapable to sustain this planet. And I completely agree, yes, this is a system that, for the most part, was created, and, you know, it's endemic with capitalism as a system. I mean, if you really want to deconstruct capitalism, that it is about colonizing the mind and colonizing the planet on all levels. And the fearful part is that it's not sustainable. I mean, this is what's really, you know, as, you know, and I say this because, you know, I'm working for a, you know, corporate law firm, and here we are just writing contracts and colonizing resources and, you know, expanding the firm and, you know, going out global, and, you know, and I say, wow, you know, there's not going to be anything left for our children. There's not going to be anything left for the plant species. There's not going to be anything left, you know, by 2050. You know, there's going to be more plastic than there is fish in the water. And so with that said, what type of system can we really construct that, for the most part, does not exploit, does not, you know, Gary just had on, you know, Russell Brand talking about, yeah, we should treat people, you know, that have chemical addiction issues, you know, as a health problem, not a criminal problem, not criminalizing their behavior. You know, where are we going to get the schools to propagate, you know, the operation of the system and the maintenance of the system? The academic institutions are not going to bring in anything new as long as corporations finance and sponsor research and as professors. You can't even get tenure anymore, okay, if your thoughts are outside the, oh, forget it, you're not going to get tenure. So where do we go with this? You know, I agree with you, too, because you were the one that said we need to demand from these politicians. We need to set an agenda, give it to them, and say, so this is what you're going to do for us. It's not you coming and doing for, you know, you telling us what you're going to do. You know, I was fearful of Obama as I drove home, okay, before he was elected, driving to my upstate home, and I was listening to the debate, and he did not have any answers. This is in 2008. He did not have any answers. In that debate, I says, I don't hear any economic system being proposed. I don't hear any, you know, reduction in military. I don't see anything tangible. So the presidents are just figureheads. You're right. I have no reason to vote. You're absolutely correct. And I never did until Obama came. And now I'm like, no, I came out the hole. I came out of the rock. Now let me go back, because, you know, because it's all co-opted. It's compromised. And you know, what can we do? Can we set a legacy by teaching children, by homeschooling them, and you know, with resources of our own, and giving them a perspective, and creating community schools, not charter schools, okay? But community schools, by a la what's his name, Jaime Escalante? Remember him, Stand and Deliver? That physics mm-hmm. professor who taught math in Los Angeles and had those students pass their first time, you know, the 17 students pass their AP test, and they didn't believe him. You know, is that what we have to do to really, I'm a child of the 60s. I'm a child of the 60s. I missed the Panther Party. I missed that. But I remember them vividly. You know, I was a Catholic school boy, which is the name of my book that I'm putting out, you know, Black Catholic Boy. As a child in the 60s, you know, my father would pass in Oakland, and he would pass these Panthers standing proud and, you know, just so just. And, you know, in Oakland, California, we lived in Alameda at that time, 1968, you know, and right before the assassination. Okay, I just remember just how proud I felt, you know, just standing in the midst of them and saying, man, this movement, it's got to go somewhere. But then, of course, COINTELPRO eliminated and cut the heads off of our people. And so, you know, I hate to say it, but come on, black people. I hate to quote Bill Cosby's book, okay, but come on, black people.
You come know, on, us, but you know, let me ask you, you're clear about the evolution of things in terms of where society as a whole has gone. Mm-hmm. Where have you gone?
I've gone to Africa, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Senegal, Cote d'Ivoire as a Christian missionary. In the Marine Corps, I went to Thailand, Japan, Hong Kong, and on the side, I will go now and then to Haiti, to El Salvador, Mexico, and support relief efforts, because my first wife was Haitian. You know, between me and you, I married three Haitian women in the 80s just to bring them in the country to get away from the Tonton Macoutes, okay? So they were after them, and ultimately one of them died from the secret police, of Papa Doc. So I'm scared, Beatrice. I'm really scared.
What do you think our mindset should be right in this moment that we're in? Should we kind of step back a little bit and say, well, wait a minute, let's analyze what the heck is going on in front of our eyes and just take a breather here, but because we know we have to do something. We may not know yet what, but at least we should recognize the moment that we're in for something that it is.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I'm just going to go back to Haki Mahubuti's book, Enemies Clash of Races. And I'm going to go back to Dr. Joy DeGoy Leary, okay, when she describes cosmology, epistemology, and axiology. And, you know, the Eurocentric cosmology, axiology, and epistemology is different from people of color, okay? Their needs are different. Just, you know, how they value a thing, how they value people. And we have to change how we value people. We have to change how we value things. You know, they said that worth... the European construct was worth is dependent upon the material possessions of the person, whereas, you know, people of color, you know, your worth is dependent upon the relationships you have with people. Okay, that was the difference in the cosmology. And so until we start saying that we need to have a better type of relationship with people, and not just people, but with, you know, the species, the living species, animals, plants, because right now, the colonization of this planet is so rampant and so consistent and so pervasive, it's going to be too toxic for us to live, okay, by 2040, 2045. The planet is going to be too toxic. And, yes, we do need to step back and think about what we're doing, because we're not doing that. We're just reacting. We're not responding. We're reacting to everything with the military hegemonic type of mindset. And analytical tools. Our tools are destructive, and they've only used destructive tools of violence because that's all the people have known coming out of the Dark Ages. Okay, and I'm just going to quote Eric Williams' book. Remember, Capitalism and Slavery. Okay, you know, not just his book, but I'm listening also to what Hilary Beckles. Okay, reparations. And, you know, it's, you don't see words like nationalism or white supremacy in the New York Times. You'll never see them, you know. And that's why I'm not a teacher in the school system anymore, because of, you know, James Lowen's book, you know, Lies My Teacher Told Me. I'm not going to repeat those lies that are told, but we need people to break through that lie and the illusion that we're creating, like in the movie The Matrix, okay, when Neo is sitting there with Morpheus. And he's telling them this is the reality we live in. And a lot of people don't like that reality. Just like Dr. Joy DeGruy says, you know, we're sitting in the room, but the white people are feeling uncomfortable. I don't want you to feel uncomfortable, white person. I'm not going to ask for reparations, because I want to have a good relationship with you. I want to be considered in that in crowd, you know. Hey, look, it's past time to feel uncomfortable because if we're wearing gas masks, okay, because of the quality of the air and the chemtrails in the atmosphere, if we can't eat, okay, outside of what we grow, we're in a bad space. We're in a bad place. And I just don't think that anyone is going to sit back and deconstruct and say, look, this is, you do it every day. I love you for doing it. Every day you sit down, you push back, and you deconstruct it. You bring it, sister. Oh my goodness, you just bring it. And I pray for your healing every day, sister. Okay.
You know? Thank you so much, Ken, for getting us started today and for this incredible contribution. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sister.
All right. Let's go to Brooklyn. Willie, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Willie. How are you?
Hi, beloved.
How are you doing?
I'm okay, my sister. How are you doing?
Fine. What are your thoughts about where we are today?
Well, first, let me start with you. I wish I could say I love you. Like everybody else, but I can't say that. I'll tell you why. No, for real, I'm very serious. Let me say what I want to say. I love Brother Claude, your father. You never said your mother's name. But those
Gertrude, for
producing a child with so much courage, intelligence, brilliance, and heart. I thank them. I love them. I kind of like you.
Well, and on behalf of Claude and Gertrude, I thank you. Thanks so much.
That's the name. Oh, yeah, right. I love what the job they have done. I wish we had 100 more of you. I really do. Well, you know, my beloved sister, you know, why are you so hard on Brother Clyde and Sister Bonnie?
Bonnie and Clyde. Mr. Clinton. The Clintons. Yes.
That's Brother Clyde and Sister Bonnie. They are something else. They are something else. You know, whatever you want to say, though, you know. We are looking for answers. And I think we have the answers right here. You know, as far as this election, well, I've never really voted in the election. I've never really done it. I've voted, but not the way they want me to vote. Now, even Brother Obama, I didn't even vote for him. But the first time, when they told him, listen, you got to denounce Brother Jeremiah Wright. I said, wait a second, because I was all for him, you know. But I said, wait a minute, this guy has no integrity. He has no decency. You've been in a church for 30 some odd years. And somebody told you to say, this guy, you have to denounce him? Give me a break. You know, now, it reminds me of you and just all of our leaders, the great ones. We run away from them instead of standing with them. I remember at WBI, I know they must be going crazy now because I remember some of the people that you brought in. These people didn't even want to hear your name. At one point in time, I said, my God, no integrity, no decency. I remember when they were threatening your life. It was three of us that came down there. You never called anybody. I said, you know, I think it's a good time to die. Because I thought when you killed Malcolm, you killed the last one. Because I'm saying, enough is enough. That's why I was down there every night because they were. I said, "If you, I'm going to, as long as you come with me." That was my position, and I think that our people, we first of all, you know, we have no respect. Most of us have no respect for ourselves, our family, and our people, because here we are. This Brother Bernie. He did not even ask us for a vote. Or Sister Hillary. I mean, Sister Bonnie. She never asked us for a vote. And we're going to just throw it to them. No. That's very, very wrong. And from my vantage point, I'm going to vote like I've always voted. And I'm going to vote for, yes, Brother Farrakhan. Why? Well, I don't like the way you treat him. An attack on him is an attack on all African people, from my vantage point. You see what I'm saying? That will tell you, listen, you will not disrespect the our leader like that. You're not going to do it. and get away with it. Particularly people like Trump and Bernie, you see what I'm saying? Because I know what they've done to the leadership of our community. Started with you. You're one of them too. That assault and that lie was started by the same people. Now, if you want my vote, here's what you're going to do. You're going to denounce the ADL, the JDL, APEC, Southern Poverty Law Center, and which other one? Let me think of the other one. You're going to denounce all of them and apologize to the nation of Israel, and particularly Minister Farrakhan. That's the only way you're going to get my vote. No other way you could do it. So in the meantime, I think if 40 million of us would go out and say, you know what? Let's write somebody. You may not like Mr. Farrakhan. I don't care about that. But as far as I'm concerned, you've always taught us about we have to have some kind of sacred cow that you just do not disrespect. And the way they treated that brother, it's very painful for me, based on a lie. And that's how I'm voting. I've already made up my mind, because I've never voted for, not even Brother Obama. The second time around, I voted for Brother Gaddafi. The second time around, because I said, you did what, Brother? You know the damage that you did? No, I cannot vote for you again. The first time was Sister McKinney. That's how I voted. So the next election, that's what I have in mind. Don't tell Garrett about this. But what I think, if the PRN listeners would get busy and begin to get people involved in their circles, and I'd like for you to run this by Gary, that we have a little fund set up for the election, and we send like $5 a month. By 2016 comes, the next election comes around, we'll have enough money if we do our work and get enough people, like half of America listening to PRN, I think we could do it. That's another way to do it. What do you think? Hello? Hello?
Yes, Willie, I'm listening to you. I'm asking the question, what period do you think we are in now politically?
The worst time. Go ahead.
No, how do you characterize this period that we're in, and what should the reaction be? What should people be thinking at this time, outside of the business that, yes, it's a presidential race, and you know it has all the earmarks of that, with people concerned about which candidate is winning and which candidate is losing and all of that stuff. But beyond that, what is this period that we're in?
Well, I'd say like Brother Kwame Ture, we're in the worst of times, and I think we're really in a bad shape, really bad shape, because with the eco-genocidal system that we're living in, the environment, you know, I mean, that's just genocidal. We have to get busy and go to work. We have many, many different organizations. You don't have to be a part of one. Join them, as many as you possibly can, and you can handle. But we cannot just lay down, because I remember the other day you played Muhammad Ali, and I was so touched by that tape. I said, look at that, brother. That's the kind of people we came from. We're the children of Malcolm X. We're the children of Marcus Garvey. We're the children of Martin Luther King. So Donald Trump, they don't face me, because I know who we are. And the only thing we have to do is begin to get busy and do what we have to do, because when African people, you may say, well, you know, that's kind of racist, but I'm going to say it anyway. When we decide to do anything, nobody does it better than we can. We're faster than anybody else. We're stronger than anybody else. We're the fittest of the fit. And I hate to say this, the dumbest of the dumb. We know this. You see what I'm saying? So if we just give, I don't know what it is. But I think the biggest problem is when the bloodsuckers took over the music industry, because they knew what they were doing when they did that. Because music reaches billions of people all over the earth. You see what I'm saying? For example, you have people in China, rapping people in everywhere. In Iran, you don't know. They don't play that kind of stuff. But the children are hiding and rapping. So that's the power of our music. And when they took over that, that was our biggest downfall. Because if you listen to the music that they play, I don't even listen to that stuff. But if you listen to the music, that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm saying you're outlining several areas in which the symptoms have been showing up. But what would you say is the overarching concern right now, politically? What should be in our thoughts and in our minds right now?
I'm not sure how to answer that, Yuki. But what I do know is that we're in the worst and yet the best of times. And we have to begin to reach out to one another and different organizations to go ahead, you know what I'm saying, you know?
Well, thanks so much for your call today.
Can I say one more thing to you, please? I don't know how you feel about David Duke, but I've been listening to that man, and I think I'd love to see an interview with him.
Ugh.
Don't laugh.
Lord. I thought you liked me.
Huh?
You liked me.
I told you.
You know, I tell you, I have a view about these things. There isn't really, I mean, there isn't very much there to learn. I would not mind interviewing people who have something to share with you that is instructive and that can teach you a thing or two. But I would say that intellectually, and I know it may sound a bit presumptuous of me to say, but these folks have plateaued. They've hit their mark. And they did that in some cases decades ago. There's very little new dimension there. I'm interested in talking to people with real dimension and who are genuinely interested in knowledge and in a fair exchange of ideas. I don't want to get involved in arguing with people who have made it very clear about who and what they're about. It's a waste of time to me. We'll talk again. Thanks so much for calling today and contributing and giving us all these things to think about. This is a question. We heard from two people, entirely different points of view, but the same idea that we are in a dangerous period. And we've got to kind of connect with that, it seems to me. What is this danger? How do we define it? What brought us here? What could get us out? And by us, what do we mean? 888-874-4888. This is the hard discussion. I know it sounds like a simple question, but it really is a very difficult one to broach. So we will be sounding very broad, perhaps. But little by little, you'll see it coming together. And you'll see the funnel. And you'll see the distillation of thought. And people will become very pointed in their views. And this is good. It's important for us to begin these kinds of conversations because, A, they're necessary, and, B, it is part of what we are supposed to be about. We're not supposed to be afraid of thoughts. What it is that people are thinking, even if we think that, oh, wow, this person is way out there. No. There is a need to appreciate where that person is coming from. What's that story? What's that journey? I think that the so-called progressive community has internalized its contradictions for so long that in many respects, the daunting task is actually to begin again from scratch with a new set of eyes, a new vision about what this world really is. I had the greatest task just in my college days, just trying to tell people, hey, you know, I appreciate your views and everything, but you don't define my world for me. And my world is entirely different from the one that you live in and the one that you are looking to address. The issues are very different. But you're not willing to extend yourselves beyond the comfort zone that was assured you when we talked about this a white supremacist world. You just don't have that idea that the world could be any different from the way you see it and the way you know it. And yet you're perfectly comfortable with the idea of coming up with solutions for it, of defining the problems in this world, and of placing yourself at front and center of the axis of power with no real intention of sharing, but instead of leading. And this has been going on for decades now. So that we hear in the midst of an election, and whether it is a Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, the dominating view has nothing to do with the popular view, or very little to do with it, because they have no intention of being informed by that world about what the issues are. They will tell you the issue is climate change. They will tell you the order of the severity of the problems, but not once being able to show you that they have actually talked to people and ascertain from them how they define the difficulties that they're dealing with and the priorities that they have. So we're still stuck with the same yawning gaps, the same contradictions, despite the fact that we claim to be in a progressive community, because it has incorporated almost all of the standing contradictions of the outside world. And that is why this conversation is very, very hard, but nonetheless very necessary. Because it seems to me that at this point, if we can't reach that point at which we can appreciate the integrity of the arguments, wherever they fall on the political spectrum, then we truly are lost. It truly is not worth even trying, because we will get nowhere. But I have a feeling that people are coming to terms with the idea that the knowledge that we have been operating with as a whole is false. It's riddled with contradictions that have kept us back, that have retarded our progress, and that will continue to do so as long as we pretend that we are genuinely engaged with each other, and we're not. We have to examine these contradictions now. This is a great time to do so. And when we do, we will see to what degree Bernie Sanders really does look a lot like Hillary Clinton. And we should be brave enough to say that. And we should be, therefore, demanding of him a different response than the response we got from Jesse Jackson in 84 and 88 and from Obama in 2008 and 2012. These are the tough, tough discussions that we need to have. We have time for Kwame. You're on the air.
How you doing, Sister Utrecht?
Fine, thank you.
Oh, it's a very tough question you put. I would say there's many reasons why we're here. One, I would say our own denial of how vicious this system is. You know, we've been basically, I would say, snowballed, blinded, and, you know, bamboozled with all this propaganda that this is a so-called democratic society, you know, democracy and all that, which is, as you know, it's just not true. There's nothing democratic about the U.S. And what we're seeing right now, I mean, look, I mean, where we're at. I mean, we're at choosing between, that's where we're going to be at, Trump and Clinton. I mean, how far can he go?
So what is the task at this particular point in time?
Good question. I mean, of course, we would say movements. I mean, build mass movements. But it seems like gets in the way is the confusion inside, and when we try to build movements, whether we're infighting or whether we have opportunists or whether we have, you know, which we have to expect that the government is going to come down on us. But, you still have to do what we got to do. I mean, we definitely need survival programs, though, too. Alternative of the government and stuff like that. I mean, we need, be creative. I mean, someone's going on in Detroit right now.
You do sense, Kwame, that we are in a dangerous period right now.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, this is a crisis period, definitely, no doubt. Major crisis period.
Wow.
And I agree with you. I haven't voted. I didn't vote in 08. I didn't vote in 2012. I won't be voting now. As a matter of fact, I never voted in the presidential election.
Well, I'm going to continue the discussion, and we'll see what people are thinking out here. But it, just the same, is a daunting moment, and we shouldn't waste it. We should really embrace the opportunity to figure out what this moment is trying to tell us to do, and to take instruction from the moment itself, and hopefully we would benefit from it.
Well, I just like listening to your show. Your show is just so refreshing and enlightenment.
Well, thank you. The show is the byproduct of everybody's input, and that's what I like about it. Thank you so much for calling and contributing.
You're welcome,
today.
Sister.
Thank you. Thank you all for contributing, and more so, I value your honesty and the integrity of your contributions and the fearlessness of what it is you say and how you say it. This is great. This is how we begin to build and rebuild community. Thank you so much for that. It does a great honor to the program and to all of the listeners, definitely, to me. I always appreciate that. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories, LEID stories at gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Tomorrow we'll talk about how people are beginning to turn things around in Michigan. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.